Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a perfect storm of political dysfunction brewing in Pakistan, where the Supreme Court has just called for the arrest of the Prime Minister, and a fundamentalist preacher is leading a horde marching on the capital, while all around the country, minority Shia are conducting sit-in protests against a government that does not protect them from religious violence meted out by murderous Sunni fanatics. An expert on Pakistan who speaks the local languages, Christine Fair, joins us to discuss a country whose neighbour India is accusing of trying to start another war. Then we'll look into the warning by the rating agency Fitch that it may downgrade US debt in another self-inflicted crisis over the debt ceiling that calls into question the predictability and reliability of the handling of the nation's fiscal affairs. William Cohan, a contributing editor at Fortune and the author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, joins us to discuss whether Wall Street, who gave the bulk of their money to Republicans in the last election, will be able to exert pressure or sufficient pressure on their political hirelings to ensure enough adult behavior to avoid a government default. Then finally, following the president's re-election victory, helped by an overwhelming vote from women, we will discuss the deficit of women in the new Obama cabinet with Michelle Kinsey-Bruns, who is the online manager for the Women's Media Center. They have launched a petition to urge Obama to appoint more women in senior positions, particularly at the FCC, to address the paucity of women in the all-white, all-male top management circles of America's mainstream media. Joining us now is Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who was a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her books include The Madrasa Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan, and Fortifying Pakistan, the Role of U.S. Internal Security Assistance. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Thank you for having me again.
And when I suggest a perfect storm, it does seem that all of the sort of political dysfunction in Pakistan, which is sort of there beneath the surface, is all coming to the surface now with the Prime Minister calling, with the Supreme Court calling for the arrest of the Prime Minister, and this preacher leading this march on the Capitol, and the Shia sit-in protests. And then on top of that, you have the Prime Minister of India basically saying that Pakistan's military are trying to cause trouble to prevent any peaceful advances between the two countries and perhaps start another war. So let's start with the big picture, India versus Pakistan. What did you make of Prime Minister Singh's accusations towards Pakistan?
Well, so in the big picture, what we have seen between India and Pakistan has actually been quite a bit of rapprochement. There have been unprecedented economic agreements. Pakistan finally agreed to issue India the most favored nation status, something which India had actually offered Pakistan decades ago. And they were actually making movement on that front. They also had agreed to relax visa regime so that you could have more people-to-people contact between the two countries. I, for one, have always been very dubious that the military would simply set back and let this rapprochement carry forward, because what primarily secures the army's right to take over the country whenever it wants, and as well as to commandeer the resources per its wishes, is this competition with India. Now, what actually happened was the Indian troops did cross into Pakistani territory across the line of control. I don't think there's any contest there. But the problem, of course, is that one of the Indians was actually beheaded by Pakistani army personnel. And obviously, that's just a whole kind of illegal. We haven't really seen the Pakistan army engage in this kind of brazen flouting of international law since the 1971 war, when it was very repressive, rapacious, and brutal to its own population in East Pakistan.
So, but there's a pattern here, isn't there? The Mumbai attacks happened on the eve of the first meeting between the foreign ministers of Pakistan and India. And again, this visa requirement, or relaxing the visa requirement to have a visa on arrival program for senior citizens from Pakistan, now that's been put on hold. So, excuse my suspicions, but I see a pattern here.
No, I mean, of course, the difference is that those previous things have all been disrupted by a terrorist attack. I mean, this is really, that's sort of like the standard operating procedure, is that there's this important rapprochement, and then there's a terrorist attack in India by a group with ties to Pakistani intelligence. But this is really different. I mean, you had a Pakistani soldier behead an Indian soldier. This is, I mean, so this is not done by a terrorist organization. This is actually done by an army that the American government likes to say repeatedly is a professional military organization. Now, we can quibble with that distinction because, after all, professional military organizations don't stage coups whenever it feels like it. But the very fact that there's absolutely no demand for punishment of this individual who beheaded this Indian soldier is really quite extraordinary. This is a really new low for the Pakistan Army.
Well, of course, there's always been the expression that Pakistan is a country, not a country with an army, but an army with a country. And a lot of people are very suspicious about this preacher who's marching on the capital and demanding that his followers are able to sit in front of the parliament. Some people are suggesting that this is yet another a kind of stealth activity on the part of the military, since this preacher is sort of approved, is he not? I mean, he's against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, but he's also essentially attacking the Pakistan People's Party and corruption in government. So to what extent is this, as is the case or has been the suggestion with the cricket star, that he was also a stealth candidate for the military?
Well, I very much am of the belief that that's the case. So one thing that you'll notice, the activism of the Supreme Court against the PPP is almost always correlated with the prospects of an alternative political power. So you would, if you followed some of the shenanigans of the Supreme Court against the PPP last year, we're looking at Memogate, we're looking at the impeachment or the removal of Gilani because he refused to reinstate some of the criminal proceedings against Zardari and send a letter asking the Swiss to do the same. The Supreme Court is galvanized to attack the PPP only when there appears to be an alternative on the horizon. Now, last year, the potential alternative was Imran Khan, and he was able to produce very large crowds, and everyone suspected that he was able to do so with the help of the army. So why would the Supreme Court coincide? Why would his activism with the PPP coincide with those alternatives? And the reason is very simple. The current Supreme Court Justice Chaudhary cannot stand the PPP. However, the army, which also dislikes the PPP tremendously, has absolutely no use for its primary and only political rival, the Pakistan Muslim League under Nawaz Sharif. Recall, he was the one that tried to kill Musharraf. So any interest in destabilizing the PPP without bringing into play the equities of the Pakistan Muslim League under Nawaz Sharif has to involve a third party. And after Imran Khan proved himself to be a completely unworthy vessel of the army's interests as well as the Supreme Court's interests, we now see this new fellow. And what's so interesting about him is he came out of nowhere. He had lived his life peacefully in Canada. He literally came out of nowhere. And the crowds that he's drawing are really unprecedented. And when you see crowds this big in Pakistan, it's not like Tahrir Square in Egypt. These are almost always orchestrated through the fine services of Pakistan's intelligence agencies. The fact that he has gotten so much money to plaster his publicity campaign all over the place also raises suspicions. Recall that only a few weeks ago, a former director general of the ISI, Asad Durrani, already confessed to using massive millions of dollars, actually, of ISI funds to manipulate electoral candidacy in the 90s. So this is something the army has long done. And so I think the suspicion, the timing of Qadri's enormous crowds, his ability to have such publicity funds, and I'll add something else that's kind of interesting. This fellow has been disporting about in this basically shaheed-proof container. I ask the question, how can some fellow who spent most of his life in Pakistan have the wherewithal to find with such expediency anyone that could fashion a bomb-proof, bullet-proof container, and then, of course, secure all the necessary approvals to do what he's done? It seems impossible to me that this has taken place without the manipulation of Pakistan's intelligence agency, the ISI.
And Christine Fair, again, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan. She's now a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University and also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. Given that there are these suspicions about these messiahs that come out of nowhere and seem to have the support behind the scenes of the ISI, and they throw all that money around, how much of that money, by the way, is from the U.S. taxpayer? Because the U.S. taxpayer has over the decades supported the Pakistan military up until, you know, the Kerry Lugar bill tried to, you know, give a little bit of money to the civilian side.
I mean, that's hard to say. Money's fungible. So, I mean, I don't want to speculate, but obviously every billion we give the Pakistanis, it frees up a billion of their own resources to do what they want. But I think the real question is, what can actually come from these instant messiahs? And I'm of the view, I mean, right now, if elections are held as they're expected to, it's going to be a really important transition. It'll actually be the second sitting parliament that served its term out without being prorogued, and it will be the first that's done so under a complete civilian dispensation. And many analysts, including myself, see that this is a really important turning point for Pakistan to really have democratic institutions take root and fructify. So it would make the ability of the army to intervene in such a drastic way increasingly less possible. And so I think the army is looking at this transition with a little bit of concern. I don't think the army really wants to let go of its ability to manipulate Pakistan's domestic politics. Yet, I think it also knows that the Pakistani public, they're not going to tolerate any disruption in the election. They're not going to tolerate a military coup. So what the army's left with is trying to calibrate as best as it can the political arrangement to its preferences. I don't think that the PPP is going to be defeated. Despite, you know, Americans see the corruption, we see the protests, I think there's a degree of orchestration. But what the PPP has actually done, despite all of its faults, and they are numerous, it's actually done more than any other government to solidify democratic institutions. It's the only president, Zardari, though he is a deeply problematic fellow, he did sign the 18th Amendment, which devolved almost all of his presidential powers to the prime minister, and he devolved power from the center to the provinces. These have been really important strides that don't get a lot of play in the Western media because we're so focused on Pakistan, the failures, not Pakistan, the success. So I would not be surprised if the PPP manages to eke out a majority of the votes. So what the army is trying to do is to weaken the PPP so that it will have to come into power with a coalition, and preferably, from the army's point of view, a coalition of its stooges. And that may be the best way to keep a rein on the PPP while also keeping politics fragile. And that way, if the government does fall apart because it was incoherent to begin with, it will not be blamed on the army, but rather incompetent politics. And so I think that might be the end game that the army is playing for. I think that's the best it can hope for, given the absolute intolerance for further army manipulation explicitly in Pakistan's governance.
And it does seem that the PPP have responded at least in part to the outrage amongst the Shiite minority in the country, who were angered by a suicide bombing that killed more than 90 Shiites in Quetta last week. There have been sit-ins all across the country, including not burying the dead and having the coffins lie out there against the Islamic tradition. And finally, Zardari's administration did agree to their demands in ousting the government in Balochistan province, where the bombing took place. So is that an example, you think, of this government being more responsive?
Well, so the Shia problem is much more complicated than this government. The Pakistan Taliban has always relied upon sectarian militias. And so as you've seen the Pakistan Taliban become more powerful, And being able to resist the writ of the Pakistani state, you've seen the sectarian groups become all the more brazen in the violence that they commit. The group in Balochistan that are particularly vulnerable are Hazaras. So they are both an ethnic minority with ties to Afghanistan. And in addition to that, they're Shia. But if you look at the data, sectarian violence has really seized Pakistan. And it's escalated just as the TTP has consolidated its position. And in fact, what you see now, Imran Khan, obviously the army, the PMLN, and the TTP has actually not been as bold as they should be. Everyone's trying to find a way of placating the TTP. That's the Pakistan Taliban. They hope that when the Americans are gone from Afghanistan, they will go and join the Taliban there to fight the Northern Alliance, leaving the Pakistanis alone. And so everyone's kind of hoping on this one solution. And so in point of fact, there's no quick fix to this, the killing of Shia, because it's so intrinsically tied to Pakistan's support of the Afghan Taliban, as well as its inability to manage the Pakistan Taliban, because it also has ties to other militant groups that are tools of the state, like for example, Jaish-e-Mohammed that targets India. So there is not going to be a ready solution to what is, I think, a genocide of Shia in Pakistan.
But just in closing, in the last couple of minutes, Chris Fair, it would seem, though, that the Pakistani military and the government, to a lesser extent, have a tiger by the tail with their own Taliban. If they think that they can export them into Afghanistan to help the Afghan Taliban fight the Northern Alliance, if they are successful and they don't fight to a draw, which it seems more likely, won't that have blowback? I mean, the idea that you get, you know, the Saudis have been exporting their troublemakers forever, and that led to bin Laden. But bin Laden's also famous for his blowback.
Yeah, and you know, the thing that I find so frustrating with the Pakistanis on the main, in both the political discourse as well as the news discourse on Pakistan's various media channels, there's no responsibility for this current situation. They park the current internal security problems at the fault of the United States. The fact is, the Pakistan Taliban would not exist had the Pakistanis not had, it's not a decade history, it doesn't go back to 89, it goes back to 47. They've been nurturing and raising Islamist jihadis since 1947. The violence that Pakistan is currently suffering is blowback. And you will find very little acknowledgement of this in Pakistan's political class, certainly not in the army. And if you watch some of the Pakistani Urdu television, as I do, as well as follow some of the key opinion makers on social media, they want to blame all of this on the Americans. And I think that the Pakistanis are going to continue to be in for one rude awakening after another. If they succeed to have their plans work out in Afghanistan, where the Taliban are back in play, they're going to have more of this violence, not less. And this is something that Pakistanis are going to have to wake up to. You can tell them, you can explain it to them, but the Pakistanis have their own narrative about what's in their interest and who's actually threatening them. And I think, to say sort of in conclusion, what Pakistanis are really fed a lot of misinformation from their own intelligence agencies. If you listen to who Pakistanis blame for the Shia violence, for some of the TTP violence, they blame the Americans, they blame the Indians, they blame the Israelis, they blame Blackwater. And so there is this complete ossified fiction that makes reckoning with the problem almost impossible in the near term.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Chris Fair.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Chris Fair, who's a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who's a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her books include The Madrasa Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan, and Fortifying Pakistan, The Role of U.S. Internal Security Assistance. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about Fitch threatening to downgrade U.S.'s credit rating. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is William Cohan, the author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. William Cohan's a contributing editor at Fortune and a writer for Vanity Fair and the New York Times, where he covers a variety of financial issues. His acclaimed book, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, details the last days of Bear Stearns and Company, and he began his career as an investigative reporter in Raleigh, North Carolina, and then went on to work on Wall Street for over a decade and a half, both at Lazard Frere and at J.P. Morgan Chase. In 2007, he published The Last Tycoons, The Secret History of Lazard Frere and Company. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Cohan.
Thank you, Ian. Always great to be here.
And Fitch, the rating agency, have just warned that they may downgrade the USA over a debt standoff, prompting the head of Fitch's sovereign rating team, David Riley, to say this is another self-inflicted crisis, and it will put into question the predictability and reliability of our policymaking when it comes to fiscal policy. Are there any adults in the room listening?
That's a very good question, Ian. I don't think so anymore. I think, this is obviously nothing new. Other rating agencies more than a year ago, noticed the same thing and have downgraded the U.S. sovereign debt before. So, unfortunately, this is nothing new. And as we saw with the fiscal cliff discussions, it's quite possible to raise taxes, as we saw, on the wealthy, which was probably somewhat long overdue. But, getting down to the nitty-gritty of cutting spending, fixing the tax code, fixing the debt ceiling problem that we're now faced with again, those kinds of issues just seem to all be bargaining chips in this great political chess game that these guys are playing down in Washington that has nothing to do, unfortunately, with representing the American people, which is what they're supposed to be doing.
So when the spokesperson for Fitch says that they're living hand-to-mouth based on robbing Peter to pay Paul, that's not what we associate with a AAA-rated government. Is that how Wall Street's looking at this? Are they wondering who's minding the store in Washington?
I was just speaking to a partner in a Wall Street firm just this afternoon, and he's an investor, and his point was sort of very interesting and also quite right. I mean, he actually isn't expecting anything out of Washington anymore, so he doesn't plan for that. In other words, he doesn't expect that they're going to be able to get their mind around meaningful spending cuts. He thinks that the tax increase has happened. That both Republicans and Democrats like to spend money. It's just a question of how they pay for it. The Democrats like to raise taxes, and so we just had that. Republicans like to borrow money, and we continue to have that. So I think his point is that meaningful reform of spending and meaningful deficit reform seems to be very elusive, and so he's not planning for it anymore. I mean, it's just, forget it. I mean, he's not going to get caught up in sort of the yo-yo vicissitudes of whether or not they'll do it or not. He's just assuming that they won't and that we will continue to have spending problems and we will continue to have growing deficit and debt problems. And frankly, we have been incredibly lucky, Ian, and I think this is obviously by design because this is, QE1, QE2, QE3, and now QE4. The Fed is intentionally keeping rates low, both short-term and long-term rates low, lower than they otherwise would be. And that hurts many people. It hurts savers, for one. It hurts people on a fixed income, for two. But it really helps the government borrow money and pay, you know, pay the interest due on that debt. If rates were allowed to go to normal levels or anything resembling normal levels, we would be bankrupt or close to it at this point. We could not afford to pay the interest on that debt if it weren't being kept artificially low. So, you know, we should be downgraded. We're becoming like a banana republic because, unfortunately, our elected officials won't do what we've put them there to do.
Again, I'm speaking with William Cohan, the author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. He's a contributing editor at Fortune and a writer for Vanity Fair and the New York Times. He's also written The House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street about collapse of Bear Stearns, and The Last Tycoons, The Secret History of Laissez Faire and Company. So, of course, the deficit hawks, as you point out, the Republicans like to borrow money and then cry out and, you know, moan about the debt, which they run up with unpaid-for wars. And after all, Bush did preside over the collapse of Wall Street, although that was a bipartisan train wreck in terms of its genesis. But the idea that these deficit hawks on the Republican side have any, why does anybody take them seriously? I mean, the last time around in August 2011, the Standard & Poor's downgraded the debt over the threat of blackmail over the debt ceiling from the Tea Party caucus. And that only had the effect of raising the cost of the debt. So if they're really concerned about our deficit, the last thing they should be doing is praying this kind of reckless brinkmanship that will add to the cost of our debt.
Well, now you're being too logical, Ian. You know, there are so many good reasons for them not to behave the way they do. There's so many good reasons for our congressmen and women not to put us in a position where it looks like we're going over a fiscal cliff or not being able to pay our debts as they become due. There's so many good reasons not to do it, and yet they do it anyway. So that, unfortunately, is the reality. You know, an interesting, you know, sidelight, again, thanks to the Fed. I mean, yes, even though our debt was downgraded, I think actually if you look at the price of Treasury securities now, it's probably high in the yield, i.e. the interest rate that people get on those Treasury securities, and they trade in inverse proportion to each other, so the price has probably never been higher. The yield has never been lower. So usually what happens when people think you can't pay your debts as they become due, they charge you more when you borrow money. And the opposite seems to be happening here. So even though we're, you know, embarking on this $15 trillion of debt and these huge budget deficits, we're about to, you know, not pay our debts as they become due, you would think that the price that it takes for us to borrow money would be going up because people would be concerned about lending us money and getting it back. So when that happens, people who lend money demand higher rates of return. But unfortunately, that hasn't happened. And one of the reasons it hasn't happened is, as I was just saying, it's because of the Fed's policy of buying up so much Treasury securities and mortgage-backed securities and driving down driving up their price and driving down their interest rates and their yields, is that basically you look around the world. And where else can investors, I mean, the logic is, where else can investors put their money? But again, I think that's faulty logic because at some point people are going to say, enough of this already. You know, America is no longer a safe haven. They can't get their act together fiscally. They can't get their act together on these deficits. They can't get their act together on the debt ceiling. And you know, they're just not functioning properly anymore, or they're not functioning the way we've come to think of America as functioning, and so we're not going to do this anymore. And when that happens, well, then Mary bar the door, because it's going to cost us a lot more to borrow money, and people aren't going to be willing to bail us out in that way.
Well, your point is well taken, but also the reality of what you've just described, William Cohan, gives a lie to the other Republican mantra, is that the United States is going to become like Greece. Well, nobody wants to lend money to Greece, and everybody's buying our debt. But obviously, at a certain point, people are going to wonder whether there's any adults in the room in terms of who's in charge of the American economy. Let's turn to that issue, because the president's really, I think, boxing himself into a corner where he simply cannot negotiate. He's refused to negotiate. He reiterated it again at his press conference early this week. And you know, the Republicans haven't said that they're going to back down. I mean, he's obviously counting on the Republicans to break ranks. Senator Lisa Murkowski's already broken ranks and said that many more of her colleagues agree with her that this is an irresponsible behavior on the part of the Republicans. But my assumption is that Obama's strategy is based in part upon the belief that the patrons of the Republican Party, after all, Wall Street gave a tremendous amount of money to Mitt Romney and withheld the kind of money they gave to Obama in 2008. So presumably there's some quid pro quo there, and you're on Wall Street, Bill Cohen. Other Wall Street is going to their Republican representatives and people they've supported and saying, you know, grow up and stop this nonsense.
Well, I suppose that they are, because, of course, they don't want this debt ceiling debate to be a cliffhanger either, because obviously, you know, the recovery is in the process of taking place. Things are looking better. The election's over. The fiscal cliff discussion has at least been kicked down the road for a few months. You know, we're trying to get our economic house in order. Interest rates are low. The market is relatively strong. It's up around 13,000 now. It's doubled since its low point when Obama first took office. I mean, there's a lot of things that seem like, you know, unemployment rate is starting to fall. A lot of things are falling into place. This debt ceiling debate, of course, will upset all that. And if they then close the government, that makes it, you know, all the worse. And, you know, as you said, it raises real questions of confidence in our system. So, of course, Wall Street doesn't like that. But, you know, you just have to look, unfortunately, at the electoral map or the political map. And, you know, a lot of Wall Street people are in New York. And I don't think you'll find that New York representatives are holding the hard line and being crazy on this issue. It's more, you know, representatives, of Tea Party districts, and a lot of those aren't particularly really found in the New York area, which is where, of course, all the Wall Street guys live. So I think the problem is more geographic, demographic. There are people, unfortunately, in the Republican Tea Party group who just feel like this was their mandate as well, to be as disruptive as they possibly can be to Obama and the Democrats. Unfortunately, they hurt everybody when they do that. And they lost this fight, at the beginning of the year with the fiscal cliff. They lost that fight, and I think Obama must be hoping that that coalition that he got to get through that momentary fiscal cliff debate is what will prevail again, in this debate over the debt ceiling. And I suspect he's going to be right, but in the meantime, you know, this vicissitudes, knowing whether or not it's going to work or not, is really debilitating, especially when you've got this nascent economic recovery trying to take hold. It's really debilitating to people psychologically, to, you know, about whether to invest new money on plant equipment or hire new workers if our government is going to go off and do bizarre world things every now and then.
Well, again, there's a constituency in the government, in the Tea Party, that seem to believe that their job is to frustrate Obama at every turn. And if the United States and the standard of living and the wealth and well-being of the country is collateral damage, it doesn't seem to bother them. In many ways, it feeds into this idea that their job is to destroy government. Or in the words of Grover Norquist, they want to shrink government down to the size where they can drown it in the bathtub.
Well, I mean, again, it's right along with Mitch McConnell, Senator McConnell, saying, you know, their purpose of the Republican Party is to make sure that Obama has only one term. They seem so preoccupied with politics as opposed to what is the right thing to do for the American people that it really boggles the mind. I mean, you know, there were many of us who were very unhappy with two terms of George W. Bush, but, you know, we had to put up with it. I don't think, you know, the position of people who were unhappy with George W. Bush was that, you know, we have to do everything we can to inflict pain on him, whether, you know, and if the whole rest of the country is collateral damage, well, that's a price we're worth paying. I mean, there are so many problems that we have in the country now that can be solved if we work together, and a great place to work together in a bipartisan way is, of course, in Congress. And we just had an election. The people spoke. And it's incredible to me that you still have these Republican congressmen who don't get that message and who can't look beyond their own district and what got them elected and do what's right for the country. I mean, this is the most foolish debate to be having. We've just come off this fiscal cliff debate. We're going to have it again in 2 months. And in the interim, we have to have a debt ceiling debate. I mean, honestly, why anybody is out there willing to buy the debt of the United States at this point when it clearly looks like it's run by a bunch of yo-yos defies belief at this point.
Well, apparently, the way these Tea Party people think, and they come from safe districts because of gerrymandering, they're more concerned about a primary challenge than they are about recognizing what happened in the last election, where the Democrats picked up a substantial, they won, I think, 25 out of the 32 races or something. The seats that were up, and Obama won handily and had a blowout in the Electoral College. It's like none of that happened to these people. But the thing that I was saying earlier, though, Bill Cohen, that concerns me is that given the irrationality of these people, then you've got Obama trying to be the adult and be reasonable and making the point in his press conference that, you know, that this is not new debt we're talking about by raising the debt ceiling. It's not new debt. We're actually paying off old bills. And it's like going to a restaurant and eating, gorging yourself, and then not wanting to pay the tab. You know, what happens there? Well, you get arrested, you know? So he's boxed himself into a corner here. He doesn't have a fallback position. So he's prepared to go to the mat on this, and he's made it clear. So the ball's in their court. And what concerns me is that they're not necessarily going to behave rationally.
Well, I agree. I mean, I agree with you. And he's clearly drawn a line in the sand. He is trying to be an adult. He probably can't believe that these children are misbehaving again. But sometime, I mean, he's a parent. He ought to know. I'm a parent. I know, and yet sometimes you don't always do the right thing when you're parenting. You can't go directly at somebody and draw a line in the sand and confront them with their bad behavior and expect them to change, because both sides will sort of dig in. He must believe, Ian, he must believe that coalition that he put together to raise taxes on the wealthiest Americans and punt the fiscal cliff issues, the sequester down the road a few months, that coalition that held and allowed him to do that is going to hold again in this debt ceiling debate, or else, frankly, he wouldn't do it unless he's going to deploy Vice President Biden again to be on a diplomatic mission with these crazy right-wing Republicans and hoping that it'll work. This is too important an issue. It's absolutely childishness and silliness that we are having this debate again. We just had this a year and a half ago and promised we wouldn't do it again, and yet here we're doing it again. I don't know why we have suddenly become ungovernable at this very moment when we need a bipartisan leadership in the country and in Congress to help us get out of our economic problems, which I really feel like we are on the edge of getting out of them, by the way. I feel a new spirit, a renewed spirit in the land of positive, economic news coming. But why are we choking? Why are we snatching defeat from the jaws of victory again? I never quite understand it. And maybe Obama has decided that he's got this coalition and this is too childish an issue to debate, and these people will come to their senses. It's a gamble. It's a bet. I think he's going to win, but unfortunately there's going to be some collateral damage along the way as we, bite our fingernails to the bone waiting to see if he's going to be right.
Well, William Cohen, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with William Cohen. He's the author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. He's a contributing editor at Fortune and a writer for Vanity Fair and the New York Times. His acclaimed book, The House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street details the last days of Bear Stearns and Company, and he began his career as an investigative reporter in Raleigh, North Carolina, and then went on to work on Wall Street for over a decade and a half, both at Laissez Faire and at J.P. Morgan Chase. In 2007, he published The Last Tycoons, The Secret History of Laissez Faire and Company. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the lack of women in Obama's new cabinet.
Well, some people try and treat me like a man. Yeah, some people try and treat me like a man. Well, I guess they just don't understand. Yeah, some people try and treat me like a man. They think I know, but that's just it, I'm a child.
Hello, woman of my. Is this not the way it seems? Purple words on a gray background. To be a woman and to be turned down. Old enough.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michelle Kinsey-Bruns, who is the online manager for the Women's Media Center. She is a longtime feminist blogger, activist, and organizer who's taken part in abortion clinic defense actions at clinic protests in seven states. She's also spoken on online activism, social media, and reproductive rights for organizations including the Feminist Majority Foundation, the Women's Information Network, Now New York State, and the National Council for Research on Women. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michelle Kinsey-Bruns.
Hi there, Ian. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And your organization, which is co-founded by Jane Fonda, Robin Morgan, and Gloria Steinem, the Women's Media Center, have launched a petition to urge the President of the United States to have more women in his cabinet. He certainly did pretty well in the first cabinet, did he not, with the Secretary of State. Catherine Sebelius is still there. I don't know what her fate is, as is the Janet Napolitano at Homeland Security. What's your sense of what the numbers are going to look like? Let's begin with that.
You know, it's tough to really predict the numbers because as the administration itself hastens to remind us, you know, they come out one at a time and they're not done yet. But, you know, forgive the phrase, but the optics of having the four big nominations of his second term be white men is discouraging for those of us who really want to see him continue a not bad record for representation of women in his administration.
So in terms of the big slots that remain, what about Attorney General? I mean, Eric Holder has not impressed very many people, particularly those who felt that there was no justice done after the Wall Street meltdown in 2008, which was attended by massive criminality, and nobody's gone to jail for that. There are some very good women, some of whom he tried to appoint in his first term, Dawn Johnson being among them.
Right. She was the nominee, actually, for the Assistant Attorney General as specifically the head of the Office of Legal Counsel at the DOJ. It's kind of a wonky, obscure position that not a lot of people have heard of, but hugely important to those in the know. And certainly, yeah, you know, having her nominated in 2009, renominated in 2010 after no action was taken by a stonewalling a Republican contingent, you know, really was pretty insulting to the plain fact that she was exceedingly qualified in by any reasonable objective standard. As at the Women's Media Center, our big push right now is actually to have a woman head of the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, that is more within the mission of our organization, which is visibility and power for women and girls in media. And the FCC is unique in that it has the greatest amount of influence over broadcast media in this country. And broadcast media is really supposed to represent the American public, right? The FCC chair is a public interest position seeking to regulate for the greater good of the citizenry. And the fact of the matter is that in 80 years of the FCC's history, there's only ever been zero women chairs of the FCC, two African-American male chairs of the FCC, and you see a distinct connection between those horrible figures and figures of media ownership amongst women and people of color. Women, according to the Women's Media Center Status of Women in U.S. Media report that we put out in 2012, only own 6% of TV and radio licenses. People of color own 3% of TV and 8% of radio licenses. This is not representative, and an FCC chair who has a little bit broader perspective than the kind of typical white male that we've become accustomed to could have real influence in making sure that American media looks like the American people.
Again, I'm speaking with Michelle Kinsey-Bruns, who is the online manager for the Women's Media Center. She's a longtime feminist blogger, activist, and organizer who's taken part in abortion clinic defense actions at clinic protests in 7 states. And we're talking about the deficit of women in powerful positions in the media and in the Obama cabinet in the second term. Of course, President Obama owes women enormously. 55% of America's women voted for him in the last election. And that so far it appears there'll be fewer women in his cabinet and in positions of importance and power. Now, the FCC, we just had this, the Golden Globes out here in Hollywood, and Rupert Murdoch apparently was interviewed by somebody and asked about whether he's going to buy the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune. And he said, well, I'm not sure, because it's a question of who's in charge of the FCC, and with the Democrats in charge, it's not looking likely.
Right. It's true, and not every eye will weep for Rupert Murdoch. It's true, but he makes an excellent point, and I think he makes my case for me, in that there's a discussion going on at the FCC right now regarding cross-ownership rules for media outlets in this country. We actually had this conversation in the FCC in 2007. There was a proposal very similar to the current one to allow Rupert Murdoch to own, you know, scads and scads of media outlets, TV, newspapers, and radio all in the same city. And at the time we had this conversation, this dialogue in the public in 2007, the public overwhelmingly said, absolutely not, we don't want that. There were 3 million public comments submitted. Thousands of people came out to public hearings to say, no, this is not in our interests. And so the proposal went down in 2007. And look, here we are. It's 2012, 2013. Current Chairman Janikowski is trying it again, but this time he's very clever. He's not doing the big public hearings. He's not opening this up to public comment. So this proposal out there, who knows where it's going to go, assuming that the FCC does change hands, which, you know, it hasn't been officially announced that he'll retire, but it's widely expected that he will. And again, you know, a woman or a person of color would help represent those numbers in a more accurate way.
Well, how does one translate the numbers with political influence here, both in the issue of the last election, where women overwhelmingly voted for Obama and clearly helped him more than any other group get elected, and yet they're not getting commensurate political clout and payoff? And then you have this paradox in the media where 75% of women are the primary shoppers for all household products, which, of course, are the bread and butter of television in particular in terms of advertising. So there again, you know, if you can't beat them politically, maybe you can beat them in terms of consumer activism. I mean, in other words, is consumer activism and political activism, can they go hand in hand?
I think that they can, and you know, to the point that you made about women controlling quite a lot of the purse strings in terms of household purchasing and driving the economy, that speaks to, for example, the issue of advertising, deceptive advertising, for example. That is a thing that has to be regulated by the government, and that is under the purview of the Bureau of Consumer Protection at the Federal Trade Commission, which is another, incidentally, big federal agency. Never had a female chair. 14 commissioners at the FTC have been women, but no chairs. And so, again, it really is a question of not making the assumption that naming a woman to either of these posts or any other instantly, you know, makes everything better. But it's simply taking into accountability a person who has the perspective to change the view. What we've actually seen in a report by Free Press from a few years ago is a good point about ownership of media, again, particularly, is that when you see media that is owned by women or owned by so-called minorities, overwhelmingly, that's local media, whereas white male media kind of correlates with big corporate media. And obviously, anything from advertising to actual media, the regulation that is imposed upon these channels, it is in the best interest of local communities for that to be locally driven.
Well, I, for one, would like to see more women ownership in the networks, because then we wouldn't have these dreadful shows. Like, I just happened to watch a bit of this thing called The Bachelor on ABC, where a whole bunch of women, really attractive young women, were there on tender hooks while some idiot guy handed them roses, and their entire fate was in his hands, and they were quivering with anticipation. The whole thing was the worst kind of objectification of women. It made them look pathetic and supine and helpless in front of some dorky guy. I mean, what happened to the feminist revolution?
Well, you know, the networks would tell you that they just put out there what folks want to see. But when a lot of the media does kind of reflect these base, low-down sexist values in many different ways, it begins to look like a situation where American media consumers are forced to choose between media that's bad or worse. You know, it's kind of a lesser of two evils situation until we can see a little bit more representational, diverse ownership, regulation, programming on all levels of media. And, you know, again, it's not that naming a woman would magically fix this, and I don't want to imply, I very clearly don't want to imply that we would expect for any woman to come in and start, you know, violating the First Amendment left and right by telling people that they can't be sexist. We just, you know, we really just want to see a broader perspective shown. And, you know, what you hear back as a response to this push of ours so often is, well, you know, are you seeking for Obama to discriminate? You know, why pick somebody based on their gender? You should pick the best candidate. To me, saying just pick the best candidate, don't pick a woman, kind of implies that there's no woman who is suitable to this job, that the best, quote-unquote, candidate must be a man. And I think best is kind of an elusive quality. What you want is a capable, excellent, qualified candidate. And there are many of those. There's an article in the National Journal in November that named straight off the bat six fully qualified, very capable women who could run the FCC no problem, two of whom are commissioners right now. So no, you know, I'm not looking for somebody to come in and ban The Bachelor. Just want somebody who has a little bit more thoughtful view on this.
Well, I guess though, Amy Poehler made up for a little bit on the Golden Globes, where after Bill Clinton's surprise appearance, when he left, she said, oh, wasn't that great? The surprise guest was Hillary Clinton's husband.
Hillary Clinton's husband. That was a fabulous line, and I enjoyed Tina Fey and Amy Poehler quite a lot. You know, their unique perspective is, it should be a little bit less unique, is what I think.
So you're talking about, in terms of qualified women for the FCC, people like Karen Kornbluth and the current commissioners, right, Mignon Clyburn and Jessica Rosenworcel.
Correct, absolutely. A couple of other names that that have popped up, particularly in the National Journal article from November, was Susan Crawford. She's a law professor now. She was President Obama's special assistant for science, tech, and innovation policy. She's also a board member of ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. The FCC is very kind of broadband focused, perhaps a little bit too much so for those of us who understand the importance of broadcast media. But, you know, for looking for an FCC that's very much focused on digital, Susan Crawford would also be an excellent choice. Susan Ness, Obama Transition Team, FCC Commissioner under Clinton. And as you mentioned, the two female commissioners, and Karen Kornbluth has just come back from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development at the UN. These are all extremely capable women who are all proven to be able to operate at high levels in a presidential administration. So, you know, we're not asking for anybody to lower their standards to get a woman in there. The point is that there are women who can do it because they're doing it already.
So Michelle Kinsey runs again the online manager for the Women's Media Center. They have a petition out now urging the President Obama to appoint more women to senior positions, both in his cabinet and in other government agencies, such as the Federal Communications Commission, the Federal Trade Commission, the U.S. Department of Justice Antitrust Division, and Commerce Department's National Telecommunications and Information Administration. Of course, the other agency that has been completely orphaned for some years now is the Federal Elections Commission. I mean, they don't even have a quorum, as far as I understand. And is there any sense there that because a lot of Americans are very concerned about the effects of Citizens United, which had a profound effect on this last $6 billion election and will continue to do so. And that maybe is a place where something can be done.
It's true, and specifically we are only just beginning to see the far-reaching effects of Citizens United that affect all people, of course, in America, but there are certainly specific implications for women as well. We saw just recently, in fact, there's the case of the crafts and hobby store based out of Texas called Hobby Lobby, and Hobby Lobby has made a case that their First Amendment rights say that they will not, they must not be forced to provide basic ordinary contraception coverage to its employees as part of its employee health insurance. And they're using as a rationale for this the Citizens United decision, which basically turns corporations into people with First Amendment rights. So certainly, you're absolutely correct to say that the FEC is also a key thing to watch as we move forward.
So just in closing, Michelle Kinsey-Burns, I also read an op-ed piece by Jane Fonda, Robin Morgan, and Gloria Steinem, the co-founders of the Women's Media Center, titled Obama Put a Woman in Charge of the FCC. Presumably that, along with the petition that you've got, is getting some attention. Where do things stand now? I mean, what are you hearing back from the White House?
You know, it's interesting. When we put out our petition first, which was Friday before last, and incidentally that petition can be signed at change.org/womenFCC, when we put this out, there wasn't yet a lot of talk about the whiteness and the maleness of Obama's second-term nominees, but within days of our putting that out, it actually started to become quite the conversation of mainstream media attention, and we saw in the press conference that President Obama had this week that they're hearing about it from us from all levels, and they do defend themselves, saying, well, wait until all of the faces come out, and that's fine, we're waiting, we just really want to see women included in them.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Michelle Kinsey-Burns.
Thank you so much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Michelle Kinsey-Burns, who is the online manager for the Women's Media Center. She's a longtime feminist blogger, activist, and organizer who's taken part in abortion clinic defense actions at clinic protests in 7 states. She's also spoken on online activism, social media, and reproductive rights for organizations including the Feminist Majority Foundation, the Women's Information Network, Now New York State, and the National Council for Research on Women. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.